Our guest this week, one of the most successful and respected local news talk radio hosts in America, is celebrating his 40th year as a broadcaster. For the past decade, the self-described libertarian conservative has hosted the morning show on Salem's AM 660 The Answer, KSKY AM, in the vibrant Dallas-Fort Worth market. Prior to that, he did a long stint at Heritage Station WBAP, also in the Dallas Metroplex. He's been a regular fill-in for Rush Limbaugh and other national hosts along the way, in addition to having written two well-received books about politics published by Regnery. Our guest this week is Mark Davis. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Interview, the weekly podcast from Podcast One for media freaks, pop culture aficionados, political junkies, and the philosophically curious. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, the Podcast One app, and Spotify. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Okay, here we go. An uninterrupted conversation with Mark Davis. Mark, I can't believe we're finally doing this type of a recording. I know we've crossed paths here and there over the years, but considering how many years we've been in this business of radio from one angle or another, it's amazing that we've never done anything together, or am I forgetting something?
No, it's long overdue to this extent of personal interaction. We've been in the same room a few times, a convention here or there. I've been witness to seeing the First Amendment Award given to some icon of our industry. And as I've traveled this path for decades and decades now, I've been a constant reader of Talkers, a constant fan of yours. And so it's just a pleasure to be in your company in this wonderful podcast interview setting that you do.
You are extremely kind, and I appreciate those very generous words. Now, have you reached your 40th anniversary as an on-air broadcaster as of the time we're doing this broadcast? We're recording this, just to timestamp it, on October 21st at 11:47 a.m. Eastern Time. You're in Texas, of course. How long have you been doing radio as a professional?
The key date circled on my calendar is October 25th. It was October 25th, 1982, on the west side of Jacksonville, Florida, where, wisely or not, WOKV, then at 600 on the dial, said, let's give this 25-year-old guy, who's our news director, let's give him something new to do. I'll give you a little background on how that all came to pass, because like so many stories of people who are listening to this, it's all about making your own luck, being in the right place at the right time. But for me, the right place was Jacksonville, and the right time was the morning of October 25th, 1982, 40 years of doing this.
How do you feel about it? The old cliche, it's hard to wrap your brain around things. Time is certainly one of them. What do you think about in terms of reflecting on the fact that you've been doing professional radio for 40 years? I still remember when I achieved my first year as a professional broadcaster making minimum wage. I actually made less money in my first job than I made in my high school job as an usher in a theater. But I was so thrilled that I actually had made it a year on the air as a professional broadcaster. I said, well, now I'm a real pro. How do you feel about the fact that you've been doing this for 40 years?
This is the perfect occasion to sort of pause and ruminate, because I haven't had much chance to. The talk show business is pretty busy, and events are busy, and an election is on the near horizon. So this is really the first chance publicly to sort of exhale and say, 40 years of doing this, what does it mean and what does it feel like? I hope this is not contradictory, but in a way, 40 years is ridiculous. I can't believe I've done anything for 40 years. I can't believe I've been breathing for 40 years, and I'm about to be 65, so obviously that's the case. But at the same time, it has flown by. One of the other true adages and cliches is time flies when you're having fun. And that thing that your dad always tells you, find something to do, that you love, and if you do, you'll never work a day in your life. Well, don't tell any of the fine companies that have paid me, but I would have done this for free, even for 40 years. And it's a remarkable thing, and it gives me, especially the time, and to do it in relatively few cities, over 40 years. I mean, I know people who can work in 7 cities inside of 2 years. I guess I've had something resembling stability, but what I've had all along is the blessing of great experiences, great listenerships, and an opportunity to be part of this craft of engaging with an audience in the most personal format of the most personal of all media.
Not only have you gone through 40 years of engaging with audiences, but think about you talk about the craft. Think about the changes that you have gone through in terms of just the mechanics and the technology, because people don't realize how close to the technology radio performers are. You know, actors and stage people and people on TV, they're sort of props, and the technicians and everybody around them handles all the stuff. But one of the things that shocked me when I first got into radio was that you run your own board. They called it comboing. I had never done that. I faked it. I came in an hour early, and I watched the guy before me, and I said, oh, my God. How am I going to do this? But isn't it remarkable how much the technology has changed in terms of the connection between your hands and your brain and your mouth over these years?
It totally is. I sit here joining you today in front of a relatively newly installed board, a wonderful piece of technology here at 660 AM The Answer in Dallas-Fort Worth, a Salem property where I've been glad to spend the last 10 years. Let's walk into the time tunnel. I'll take a real brief snapshot.
Yeah.
It's that morning of October 25th, 1982. I worked for AM-FM Combo, owned by Affiliated Broadcasting. It was the Boston Globe. And the FM was 97 Wave FM, an adult contemporary powerhouse. And the AM was struggling playing music, as all AM stations were doing, struggling playing music. And so many of them were turning to the spoken word format. So WOKV did. They had no budget for this, so they plugged into the ABC Talk Radio Network, which was basically a litany of KABC and other California hosts who were great, Michael Jackson, Owen Spann, Ray Bream, and that was the entire day, but they left a morning drive vacancy, figuring that stations would want to put in their own local morning show. So having no money and no real plan, they came to me, I was news director at the time, and they said, would you like to do this for the same money? How could I refuse?
Wow.
So I walked into it. So you think of a radio studio. Everybody think of padding on the wall, a board that might be new, might be old, microphones, a bank of phone lines, et cetera, et cetera. What they had done is they took a spare office, and it was clean and thoroughly comfortable, but it was basically an office table with a stack of mixers that a broadcaster of today might do for a remote from a car dealership, a table-mounted microphone in front of me, an old Radio Shack TRS-80 for call screening from a guy who sat across the hall from me, and I sat down in that room and did my first show in Jacksonville under just those circumstances for about 2.5 years. I made it work. It was fine, but it was well after that before I walked into what was really an actual purposed radio studio.
Very interesting. Now, I gather from this that you came into the business through journalism and always worked in spoken word radio. So many people who've been in the business as long as you and I have came through music radio and then graduated into talk when the programmer starts saying, shut up and play the records. That was the impetus for a lot of people to go into talk, because you really had to have what was called a good rap, not to confuse that with the music format, although there is the similarity that they're spoken more than sung. You had to have a good rap to be a good DJ, especially my origins in progressive rock FM album radio. If you did a show and you didn't come up with some kind of heavy rap, man, where you're talking about the culture and
that's
the music,
right,
you know, you weren't good. So then when it started to go into computerized music and liner notes, a lot of guys made their exit and went into went into talk radio. But I know you're from Texas, and I know that you were a journalism graduate back, I think, in 1979 at the University of Maryland. What kind of a kid were you that led you to want to be a journalism student and then, of course, a news broadcaster at a station in Jacksonville?
Well, thank you for the opportunity to give huge credit to my parents and my upbringing. I grew up in the Maryland suburbs of Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. Dad was in the Air Force, but unlike the average military brat who lives in 14 different places, for the biggest stretch of his service, he was stationed at the Pentagon, Andrews Air Force Base, and Bowling Air Force Base, all right there in the D.C. area. So I got to grow up mostly in the exact same house in Prince George's County, Maryland. I was an only child. I knew I loved to write. I knew I loved current events. I mean, Watergate is happening when I'm in high school. Vietnam is happening throughout my teenage years. My dad is in the military. My mom was always plugged into current events, so we were a very talky household, lots of hot opinions flying back and forth. And so as I went into college and left high school, graduated in 75, went to Maryland because it was up the road, I said, what do I want to major in? I know I like to write, even creatively, but I don't want to be an English major because I want to actually get a job. So I thought, I also love current events. Let's try this journalism thing. And so for my freshman and sophomore years at Maryland, it was all about journalism, but it was print. And I was learning what by today's measure would be the stone knives and bearskins methods of assembling a newspaper. And then about halfway through, someone said, hey, up on the top of the main dining hall in College Park, there is WMUC, the campus radio station. They're doing auditions for everything. Why don't we go see how that works out? So I walked into that environment and never looked back. And the great thing about college radio, which many people listening will be able to attest to, is you get to do a little bit of everything. I did sports play-by-play. I alphabetized records in the album library. I did a disc jockey shift to go right to what you were saying about music radio. I think every talk show host either wants to or has benefited from some level of playing records and the rhythm and the delivery. And I had a couple of years of doing that while also cutting my teeth on cutting tape and editing news stories and writing news stories. So that when I graduated in the summer of 1979, it was time to go get that first radio news job. And I had two glorious years in Charleston, West Virginia, and then Jacksonville, Florida. And that's where all the dominoes fell. I was news anchor and reporter. The news director left. They gave me his job. And then just a few months after that, they said, hey, do you want to do a talk show?
It's very interesting. Now, I'm going to jump around a little bit. You know, you were therefore a journalism student back in the 70s into the 80s, and Watergate was happening when you were in high school, which was a high point for journalism, made it very glamorous and investigative journalism and all that stuff. How would you say journalism has changed in the last 40 years?
The easy observation that I could make and that I obviously do make on the show that I host, a conservative activist show that I host, is that media corruption has poisoned everything and it's all dishonest, which, by the way, is largely true. But I don't think that's the vein in which you're asking. When I was in journalism school, actual journalism school, in the Carter administration, right, 75 to 79, Ford and Carter, I don't remember in a business that is supposedly so liberally tilted, in a state and at a university that is pretty liberally tilted, I don't ever remember any professor, any text prodding me toward one political direction or another. It was about the craft, how to find stories, how to disseminate stories, how to be good at writing. Then we got into actual courses and classes on tape editing and the nuts and bolts of print and broadcast. I learned way more at the actual campus radio station than I ever did in any journalism class about that. But it was all about the history and the law related to mass communications, and I just absolutely loved it. So that when I come out into the actual business, as the Carter years are ending, and I instantly get to cover the 1980 election and the ascendancy of Reagan, but I'm not a talk show host yet. I'm just covering the news. I'm at the Kanawha County Courthouse in Charleston, West Virginia on election night, watching the returns come in from the presidency on down to West Virginia state races. Still, it's not as though everything was so balkanized and so politicized. It's kind of an innocent golden era to me now, because it wasn't long after that, and right in time for me to become a talk show host, that everything became very much of a political hotbed. That's worked out very well for me, for what I do. But if I'd have stayed in radio news my whole life, or TV news, or been right, it's got to be a weird time to call yourself a journalist in the traditional sense.
It is. It's some of the principles of journalism, sort of like the Hippocratic Oath, do no harm, professions that have these tenets of conduct and ethics and etiquette. A lot of that has been lost, and I know that journalism schools have been having a lot of problems dealing with the fuzzy line between teaching the tenets of journalism and helping their students be prepared to find a job in the real world. There's a big gap between those two things. Now, you said earlier you didn't think I was asking the question in the spirit of, I think you used the word, corruption in the media business when it comes to journalism, but that piqued my interest. So I am interested. What did you mean by that?
Well, imagine being a journalism student with the purest of motive, saying, I want to try as best as I humanly possibly can to keep my own views out of stories, to have no reader know what my personal politics are, to deliver both sides of a news story and let readers make up their own minds. What a dinosaur concept that has become. In some of the ivory towers of our major metropolitan daily newspapers, and certainly in cable TV news, you've absolutely got to provide an agenda, because the perception is that that's what the readers and the viewers want. And unfortunately, we have, rather than push back against that, I mean, even if a newspaper wants to be editorially liberal, to have their op-ed pages, their editorials, take whatever view they wish, to at least say to the reporters, keep your views out of it. That seems to be a bygone day. And we have journalism professors today speaking ill of that objectivity obligation, professing a necessity, a moral necessity for reporters, not columnists, not talk show hosts, not pundits, for reporters taking a side, as if not doing so somehow ill serves the democracy.
Yeah, well, from a commercial standpoint, it's also been in vogue now for about 25 years. It's been a slow process to go from putting it out there and seeing what you attract to targeting audiences based upon what they already want. And now we're in it's hyper-targeting. Okay, where's the vacuum? And then you do the daily dance of affirmation. You tell the people what they want to hear. It's sort of like on sports shows. If you're dealing with a home team crowd, you tell them, oh, yeah, we've got a good chance of making the playoffs. They don't want to hear that.
Right.
They don't want to hear that. They go for that adrenaline rush of affirmation. And it's a purposeful thing, and it could be very good for getting the low-hanging fruit out there. It does eventually have diminishing returns, but it's a safer way to go through the business of broadcasting and any kind of media, because all media now is blended together. Broadcasters are also podcasters, are also blog writers, and the separation of the different disciplines within media has kind of disappeared. But I find what you're saying very interesting, and I've experienced it as well, obviously. As far as journalism professors or professors in general thinking that it's the obligation of the student, the journalist, or the graduate in any form to have a political take, I find that to be a widespread problem. That's not to say there aren't schools out there on the high school, but more importantly, the college and university level that are objective. They're not objective. There are there. But I find that the wokeism and in this case, the liberal end of it really has grabbed a hold of the academic culture on a level that I think personally is not good for the country. And I know you probably agree with that.
No, indeed so. And this is what points up the enormous, irreplaceable value of talk radio. People constantly ask me, and I know they ask you, you know, why in the world is talk radio, the political arm of it, why does it seem to be, you know, 70-30, if not 80-20, conservative? Doesn't talk radio need balance? And I always tell people back, talk radio doesn't need balance. Talk radio is balance. It is the one thing we've got as the left owns cable news. I mean, you got Fox News, I know, but as left is dominant on cable news, dominant on ABC, CBS, NBC, dominant in the major metropolitan dailies, dominant in Hollywood, dominant in academia. This is the one thing we got. And I think it's been a marketplace response to the liberal slant of all those other things, which, by the way, I'm fine with. I'm a marketplace guy. If there's too much liberalism out there in this venue or that bubble or that environment, it's up to conservatives to provide alternatives. We've done it in talk radio for decades now, and we're certainly doing it in various online ways, in certain, you know, obviously, the example of Fox News and Newsmax and other cable. I mean, we're out there duking it out as it should be.
And, of course, a lot of the conservative outlets are duking it out with each other. And just because conservative radio hosts may be on the same side ideologically doesn't mean that they're not in competition with each other for prominence within the conservative, universe, which brings up the question, how do you feel as a conservative about those conservatives with whom you disagree, and particularly those that maybe in the privacy of your own mind you really think make conservatives look bad or serve up a great target for those who want to tear down conservative thinking?
My, what a great question, because there are two ways for me to look at that. First, let's define the landscape. There's nothing funnier than when everybody says, all those conservative talk show hosts, you know, march to the same drum, they're echo chamber, they all feel the same way. It's so predictable, it's so lockstep. Really? Have you listened to a show in the era of Trump? Find me 10 conservative hosts, ask them about Donald Trump, and step back and watch the ensuing firestorm. Ask them about whether Trump ought to run in 2024 or whether DeSantis is better. Ask them about any one of a number of, how many abortion restrictions should there be? Should there be the rape and incest exception or not? How pro-life are you? There is enormous diversity among conservative hosts on a number of issues. And by the way, I think that is good, and it should be represented on a variety of shows. So I could drive around and listen to 100 shows, and I might hear a host who's maybe less conservative than I am, or maybe doesn't have the exact same take that I do, and I would listen and say, I disagree with that host. That's fine. That's why I'm a constant consumer of liberal radio and television and print material, because I want to experience what other people are thinking so that I can understand it better and respond to it better. But to go to the other end of your question, what about the notion of, are there somewhere in our industry shows that have simply not served conservatism well? You know, that's where I begin to say, is it my job to rag on other shows?
Great point.
And I know you're not asking me to. I know that's not what you're asking at all. And in fact, so let me wrap up an already too
long. No, it's okay, because that's one of the themes that I've been thinking about this particular week. Because
I can imagine so. So I can guide you right back to your next observation or question. There are shows I hear where I wonder, how can this be popular? Either because it is joyless or scolding or unpleasant for me to listen to, but that's just a show that's not my cup of tea, because every once in a while some of these shows will be wildly popular, at which point I bow to the marketplace and say listeners will listen to what they wish and avoid what they don't. It is a lack of listenership or a lack of advertising appeal that should determine when a show goes away, not because Mark Davis doesn't like it. So at this point, I guess maybe it's unavoidable. We go to the example of the moment in the news with the story of Alex Jones, someone who I've never had any great. I think Alex is as crazy as an outhouse rat, but I don't care. I've never cared by and large the conspiracy theories, this, that, whatever. But when he winds up in this trial, which I think he was found guilty and properly handed an award of $1 billion for the savagery that he showed to these grieving families in Sandy Hook, that seems like the wheels of justice turned. The problem for me, for our industry, is then the media culture predictably goes out there and says, look at that. That's conservative talk.
Exactly.
Radio.
Exactly.
When it is nothing of the kind.
Exactly. They'll define him as right wing talk show host Alex Jones.
And yeah, there you go.
And whenever I see that, I bristle. In my opinion, and I'd like your reaction to this, because this is – I'm interviewing you, but sometimes your reaction to my opinion is something that brings out some interesting insights. In my opinion, one of the things that is really coarsening our culture and making it so contentious and divisive is the tendency these days of media platforms to attack each other as opposed to running their own race and not – giving a damn what the other guy is doing. The amount of time that is spent, and we study this at Talkers. I mean, we measure words on the air and in the, you know, online, you know, whatever the air means anymore. And it's an extraordinary percentage of conversation takes up the task of attacking other platforms, radio shows attacking other radio shows, hosts attacking other shows. Now, on one station, that used to be kind of cool. There was point and counterpoint. There were feuds between guys, you know, the morning guy against the afternoon person. But there is so much vitriol spent. And the big platforms do it too. You know, CBS News did this hit piece on talk radio last week. Back, you know, in terms of the time frame we're operating on, and that's been a big buzz in the business. What do you think of my feeling that would be a great thing to start to move away from, and not worry about other
hosts? Of course
it
would. Of course it would, but you're asking a lot here, and you're nobly and asking it in a praiseworthy way, but it's a big part of current human nature. It's probably a dark underbelly of human nature. TV networks, the traditional TV networks, hate conservative talk radio, and so they're going to bag on us. And so, you know, then we all get on our shows and say, look what these people said about us. And in a weird way, the marketplace kind of works. Let them say what they want to say. We'll say what we want to say. But you're still right. You're really still on to something. It used to be like in a given market where you had a battle between talk stations or rock stations or country stations, that everybody would just stay to their own lane, and the ratings winners would win, and the people who were not winning would try to do better and try to catch the front runners. Now you get like a hot AC morning show that would just savage the competition. And the reason that worked is listeners tended to like it. Not that everybody, you know, needs to follow the exact Howard Stern example, because he's kind of a singular figure, but the degree to which Howard would just brutalize his New York local radio competition or in Cleveland or Philadelphia or wherever. But people tended to love it, but they loved it because he did it with a certain style and a certain sense of humor. These days, what you have is, for example, let's say MSNBC doing an entire evening of hand-wringing over what Tucker Carlson did last night. Mm-hmm. It's like, really? If I want to watch Tucker, I'll watch Tucker. If I like it, I'll keep going. If I don't, I won't. But I think that they are obsessed by what the other people are doing. Usually, it is the folks who are lagging in the ratings who are obsessed with what other people are doing and are trying to bring them down. It rarely works. Every time MSNBC savages Sean Hannity, it probably gains Hannity a couple of listeners.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know the old saying, as long as they spell my name right.
That's right. No bad breath.
And, you know, it would almost be like going to the Olympics and watching a race, and everybody's in their lane. And instead of everybody running as hard as they can, you know, until they get to the finish line, elbowing, like roller derby, elbowing the other guy, tripping the guy, fighting with, you know, there are some sports that have sportsmanship and others that are very popular for being dirty. And that's sort of what it looks like to me. And I'm not condemning it. I just am saying I think that that's leading to the bigger picture, aside what gets ratings, aside what makes money, aside what people like, just the problem of what clearly appears to be the coarsening of our culture. And that's a concern I have outside of my business interests, which sometimes are at odds with my deeper concerns. We all face that, a certain level of compromise. If you want to be in the game and have any impact, you got to play the game the way the game is scored. And we all face this type of conflict, I would think. And I think we should be sensitive to other people facing it as well.
You know what? As you laid out that poetic paragraph, it was beautifully put. And since I was agreeing with it so much, I began to think, is this kind of a generational thing? As you and I, who have been at this for a while, have these observations, and people who are listening, who might be in their 50s, 60s, or beyond, are agreeing with us. And I found myself thinking, what would the 20-somethings, the 30-somethings in the industry, what would their attitudes be? Because those are the attitudes that are going to carry forward in the coming decades. And then I ran into the brick wall, and we can spend a moment on this if you want to. When I was coming up, 40 years ago, I'm giving a show just a few weeks before my 26th birthday, and I had a landscape in front of me where I'm in Jacksonville, a medium market, and then I found myself in larger markets. But and once you get to a city of a relative size, there were three or four talk stations that each had three or four local hosts. There were scores upon scores of major market local talk radio gigs that you could envision yourself occupying if you were good enough and lucky enough in the ensuing years. That is gone. I do not bemoan syndication or a station that wants to run a whole day of satellite shows and put in one local guy. I work for that environment right now. God bless them. I'm the local guy. Glad to be. But gone are the days, Michael, when there are people who come out of college, maybe they're a reporter, maybe they're some other walk of life, and they do something else and then become talk radio hosts like Mark Levin. Those days are gone where somebody can be 20, 25, or 30 and say, I want to be a talk show host, because the jobs have shriveled to a really unfortunate rarity.
Do you, as a guy who's come up through the culture of radio stations, do you feel a sense of loneliness, cultural, professional loneliness, being the only real local guy on a station that's otherwise full of syndicated shows?
What a great question. It would not be loneliness, because especially when I've lived here back in my native Texas for, almost 30 years, I know a lot of guys, and a lot of them are sports talk guys, and some of them have shows on other stations. It's not like they're gone. But when I got here, there were probably 10 or 12 names you could name of local hosts who actually had some listenership, and now they're like three or four. But I know them, and I'm cordial with them, so it's not like it's a solitary existence. What I miss is the ability to finish my show in the morning, get out and drive around and pick from two or three or four other guys or gals and see what their take is about local things, because local shows have been in a great, great decline. And I hope that is a pendulum that can swing back. I know what the economics are. You got to pay money to a local guy. I hope that local talk radio can have a resurgence.
I hope that local radio and local hosts have a resurgence as well, just from a standpoint of it'll make the industry more opportunity laden for people to go into it. Everybody can't start at the top. And plus, it sounds good and it serves the community. I appreciate your mentioning and gals, because every time I say guys, I'm saying, okay, I better do the disclaimer. I better do the disclaimer soon, because I'm going to get letters from people, because this is out there. This is out there in the universe. Not only can it be heard all over the world, but, every light year further into the Milky Way galaxy, but it goes into the future. This conversation might be listened to 1,000 years from now. Can you imagine by somebody who goes, oh, How quaint. If I only could understand that old English that they're talking about. So when I use the word guys, I mean it in the totally, absolutely all-inclusive sense that it's guys, gals, and anything in between. Because I was thinking that, going, all right, I'm saying guys a lot, guys, because I'm talking to you. Like, you know, that's the way we would talk if we were having a beer together, not to assume that you are a drinker.
And we'll be into either of us. To use the term mankind. So let's all be careful.
Exactly. A couple of questions that I want to throw at you that are not in any kind of sequence here. You mentioned that you grew up in a military family. What impact did that have upon you growing up in that environment?
It was the era of Vietnam, and yet my dad was stationed at the Pentagon doing a lot of personnel-related things, and so he never went to war. But a lot of my friends' moms and dads, friends' dads did, and that the Vietnam era had an effect on me, and that's when military service became pretty culturally unpopular. So I was always glad to see my own dad, and it was in a street in a neighborhood that had a lot of military families, and it was enriching and nurturing to grow up in an environment that still held military service as a praiseworthy value, even as guys were getting spat on and called baby killers as they came back from Southeast Asia. When my dad retired from the Air Force in 1969 and then went into the private sector and sales and management and things like that, I maintained my appreciation for his service, and I knew I made the compartmentalization that some wars may be popular, some wars may be horribly unpopular, but anyone who puts on the uniform and serves the country, anybody who follows those orders, even maybe orders and deployments that the soldier, the sailor, the airman may not agree with, is one of our highest and most noble callings. And that's a belief I've carried through my entire life.
Now, another track here. You've written a couple of books in your time, and one of them is called Lone Star America, How Texas Can Save Our Country. Tell us about Texas saving our country.
So I came back to my native Texas, an opportunity to come work first for WBAP in 1994, and I had just the most wonderful run. It's just glorious. It's all been great, and the cylinders are all running. And then I come here into the Salem property at 6:60 a.m. The Answer in 2012. A couple of years after that, the good people at Regnery Publishing, which we had a real close relationship, so close that we eventually bought them, an editor from Regnery calls and says, there's a book we'd like to market. There's a book we'd like to put out. Could you write it? And it was basically, and remember, this is about 2014, Texas was very much in the news. Rick Perry is governor, about to give way to the Greg Abbott. You know, Texas is always in the news. Everybody's always talking about Texas, how much they love us, how much they hate us. We're always very front of mind. So they said, if we gave you a premise, and that premise is that Texas ideas are so good, are working so well in the Lone Star State, that the entire country would do well to follow its example, could you write that book? And I said, give me 3 months. And I did it. And it was Lone Star America, How Texas Can Save Our Country. And it's, I think a lot of it's held up pretty well. It's generally an idea about how conservative governance is attractive, how doing things the way we have done it's the reason why people are tripping over each other to move here and escaping California like a sinking ship. So I was very, very proud of that. And then 2 years later, Regnery kindly took an idea that I had. I said, let's take a look at all of these things that I argue against, all these liberal ideas that I say are terrible, but let me do it with a sense of grace and good humor and kind of provide an issue-by-issue conversational guide so that people who read the book can have a way to respond when someone says, you know, that Obama's the greatest president ever, or we don't really need borders, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that came in the form of Upside Down, How the Left Has Turned Right into Wrong, Truth into Lies, Good into Bad. Sounds pretty combative, but it's really just kind of a conversational guide for conservatives on how to arm yourself with a few facts and a few good attitudes and argue for conservatism in a positive way.
What advice can you give anybody listening to this who is in the media and may feel they have a book in them and are, thinking of someday writing a book? What are your insights into the state of book publishing and being an author in general as a professional pursuit?
couple of things. When you have an idea that you want to pitch, make it something that is at least somewhat different than what everyone else is doing. If there are already 10 books in the last few years that make almost exactly the same point that you're making, the marketplace for it is not likely to sprout. It doesn't mean that you can't take a look at something that seems to be a burgeoning trend and sort of piggyback onto that. Maybe you want to be, you know, one of only a few authors talking about something maybe the best thing I can do is give an example. Here's something, if I weren't doing something else, here's something I might do a book on right now. So everybody can take this and, you know, give me a finder's fee if this is an idea. The tyranny of experts. Everywhere there's a story about, well, experts say this about COVID, or experts say this about election misinformation, or experts say this about some subject, when usually the expert is so full of it and really just somebody who might have a degree in something that some media outlet decided to use because it forwarded their agenda. The tyranny of experts is something that maybe an author can turn into a 250-page masterpiece about how the notion of expertise has been corrupted. And when you hear about an expert, you have to really look hard and see if the person really is an expert or just flogging a political point they want to make. That's something that people have been saying for 5 or 10 years, but maybe a good solid book that goes and finds some good examples and documents them well and offers up that message in a readable, entertaining way, that might be a path towards success.
Interesting. Now, what are your, in conclusion, because I've given you a hell of a workout here, and I'll be kind and let you have a bathroom break and then go and leave the station. But any unfulfilled desires, dreams, ambitions in terms of what you would yet like to do in your life?
Absolutely none. And I had the chance to fill in for Rush Limbaugh for 4 years when I was at BAP. It was an unbelievable honor. Now in this local show that I do, part of my gig is to fill in for the other hosts on the Salem Radio Network, Dennis Prager, Hugh Hewitt, et cetera, et cetera. So I have my feet in both worlds. I don't ever want to give up local radio. In fact, people have said to me all the time, and they're always very kind to say so, don't you want a syndicated network show? Don't you want a national show? No. If I could have it all to do over again and have somebody tap me to be, you know, Limbaugh, Hannity, Levin, God bless those guys. They did it, and they did it perfectly. But for me, that would have meant leaving local radio. As it is now in the career that I've been blessed to have, I've had the chance to put my toe in the pool of national radio and talk to national audiences every once in a while. But then I come back to what my real job is, serving this community in North Texas. And if I want to talk about something local, I can. If I want to talk about Biden, I can. If I want to talk about Governor Abbott, I can. If I want to talk about Ron DeSantis, I can. If I'd gotten this magical national show, I would never be able to talk about what some local school board in Fort Worth was doing. I wouldn't be able to relate to and speak to and share concerns with this local audience in the way that I have. And the last thing on this is, even the meaning of local radio has changed because you know how many calls I get sitting here in Dallas-Fort Worth? How many calls I get from Indiana and Indonesia because people are listening to the podcast and they found the show or they found my Twitter feed, at Mark Davis, and they know where to listen to us online? Even the meaning of local radio has blurred. So I've had every bit of impact and recognizability and fame and made a wonderful living. There's truly nothing else that I would have wanted to do.
And there you have it, an uninterrupted conversation with radio talk show host Mark Davis of AM 660 The Answer in Dallas. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and the Podcast One app. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you like this show and find it to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you're interested in hearing my weekly 1-hour radio show, The Michael Harrison Rap, check out mhwrap.com. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison, The Michael Harrison Interview. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Interview is a production of Good Phone Communications, presented in association with Podcast One and Talkers Magazine. Copyright 2022, all rights reserved.